Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Mr. Herman Pretorius. Let's get into our first news story of today, and this is about the IRR's new draft value, or the IRR's new draft legislation, the Value for Money Bill, which seeks to address problems in South Africa's procurement system. So we talked recently on the show about the Democratic Alliance putting out legislation that sought to move away from race-based empowerment in BEE. And I thought that this was a very positive step, that this was a correct move in the right direction, away from the failed corrupt system that has been a result of ANC policy over the last couple of years. But we can do even better than that. South Africa truly wants to see the success that it is capable of. We need to go even further than the political parties are at the moment willing to go. And part of that is contained in the our ideas contained in our Value for Money Bill. Herman, do you want to take us through exactly what this is and why exactly this is better than some of the other proposals out there about how to change procurement?
Yeah, so firstly, I think it is incredibly to be welcomed that we are actually now in a situation where there's a debate about procurement policy. And we want this debate to continue to intensify because it is a part of the BE discussion that sort of gets glossed over and that people don't quite seem to understand, is that BEE is labeled as an empowerment policy, but it is actually a procurement policy 90% of the way, in the sense that an empowerment policy, you would expect to be sort of a funnel for opportunity, for assets, for upliftment, where a procurement policy determines how contracts are awarded, which contracts are awarded, to whom and on what criteria, those sorts of things. And BEE really, to a very, very significant extent, is a procurement policy, not an empowerment policy. So when we talk about procurement, we talk about BEE. And when we talk about BEE, we need to address the elephant in the room, the fact that we can put a number on what BEE has cost ordinary South Africans above what another approach would have been. And that is the approach of value for money. In section 217 of the Constitution, the obligation for cost-effective government and procurement is put in black and white. And in the Zondo Commission report, former Chief Justice Zondo also finds that this value for money question was at the heart of much of the Bosasa state capture issue, is that the moment you have a system where procurement doesn't go to value for money, i.e. you don't have a system where you can win a bid based on how effective, cost-effective, affordable, quality assured you can deliver, but on other criteria, you open the door for manipulation of that criteria. And that's the problem with any points-based system for procurement, is if you only award government spending in terms of procurement contracts on the basis of who can do the best job for the best price, then you don't allow for space for rigging, thumbing the scale, manipulating the facts. And you also don't have this extra procurement burden of checking up on whether the points awarded are actually fair. And the sad thing is both BEE and the DA's proposals have components of moving away from value for money and making other considerations weigh in the decision of who gets the final procurement tender or contract or whatever the case may be. Now, I think the DA's policy is good. I don't think it's perfect. I think it's good because the BEE scorecard does not value for money almost at all. If you look at the 105 right. points on a BEE scorecard, you've got 40 points going to whether you've got procurement, BEE procurement recognition. That's whether you as a company procure for yourself from other BEE companies. So immediately you've got the single largest allocation of points on the BE scorecard is towards a sort of elitist, clicky business circle thing where these businesses start becoming very incestuous. Then you've got 15 and 20 points for considerations of management positions and shareholding schemes. And that's obviously bad because it's so elitist, it is so open to manipulation that it really hasn't worked. It's not even the racial component of BEE that has opened the door to corruption. It's the thumbing the scale issue. Now, the DA's proposal is a significant improvement in the sense that it gives an 80% weight to value for money competition. That is good, because immediately you're getting rid of the sort of rigging system and the thumbing of the scale that BEE has entrenched. But in that remaining 20%, you still have a points-based system that could end up in a corrupt sort of bureaucratic situation and will end up in the taxpayer not getting value for money. And that's the nub of the matter. That's the heart of the value for money bill, is if we want value for money, have value for money. If we want service delivery at a cost-effective rate, have service delivery at a cost-effective rate. Let's stop pretending that services to the poor and the core functions of the government on which the poor are most dependent is somehow a lever to pull for transformation of whatever kind. And there's the rub for both the DA's problem, right, proposed, and BEE.
Yeah, the it's sort of in some ways it's kind of asking companies that are bidding on these products in the DA's bill to also fulfill essentially development government objectives, right? Like, you know, are you providing education for people? Are you, you know, supporting NGOs in your environment? And this, you know, adds the cost of doing business as well. So it's not just that you're losing sort of the potential value for money that the poor might get in terms of, you know, what tax money is being spent on, but you're also still a bit of a drag on businesses, right? There's still a lot of regulations. There's still a lot of reports that you need to submit. You know, we gave this much money to this thing. And then in theory, in a correctly working system, that would all have to be checked up on, and you can still have delays and problems there. I think that is entirely justified, and that's why this approach is better, for sure.
And to add to the problem with the social development goals, and don't get me wrong, I think this is a step in the right direction. If this became the law in South Africa, I would be happy, because it is a step in the right direction. But the problem with the SDGs is that there is still something of an insider's benefit here. The larger companies will have the bigger capacity to meet SDG goals. So it doesn't actually open up the type of empowerment that would be available in a free market. If I am a young entrepreneur with a really incredible new product or service that can do something that the government needs at a fraction of the cost, and I don't have the institutional backing or the HR firing power or, you know, some of the more intangible corporate benefits of being a well-established company, I can be as talented and as efficient and as cost-efficient as I want to be. I cannot compete on the SDG grounds. And that's the real sad thing, is we want innovative competition for cost-effective delivery. You can't disconnect the two. So even if you are asking these companies whether they're selling laptops to plant trees or whether they are selling toilet paper to build schools, you are muddying the waters in terms of adding to the cost of doing business, adding to the taxpayers' bill, and also creating quite an elitist, pro-establishment, anti-innovation market, which is unfortunate, because procurement in South Africa is a massive part of the economic flow and activity. And if that is, as it were, a captured closed market, it is a part of the economy that can be more dynamic, that can be more innovative, and that can be more rewarding to the taxpayer. So, you know, good. DA, yes, let's go. Let's get away from race-based policy. Let's get to at least 80% value for money. But why not 100% value for money? And that's why the IRR will keep pushing for this. We'll acknowledge steps in the right direction, but there's still a destination to reach. If you say it's a step in the right direction, the assumption is that the journey isn't done.
No, that's exactly right. And, you know, I look forward to a future in South Africa where the debate is between, you know, our version of this bill and the DA's version of this bill, rather than the current status quo, which is, you know, this completely dysfunctional system that that has been created by BEE. It's let's move on, I think, from this topic on to, well, regulation. So this is from Currency News. They recently held an event where the CEO of Remgro was talking a little bit about the effects on ordinary people's lives that damaging government regulations and over-management of the economy can actually produce. So speaking at this currency event in Cape Town last week, Yanni Durand, who is the CEO of Remgro, said that his company had been working out this fiber merge deal with Vodacom that would allow them to have a much bigger stake in the fiber market. And the plan was, as part of this, to roll out significant amounts of internet infrastructure to poorer suburbs in South Africa across many townships. Durand says that if the 11 billion rand deal was approved, in which Vodacom would buy 30% of Remgro's fiber arm, it was approved, they would roll out, they reckon, billions of rands of infrastructure development. They say 10 to 15 billion rand on fiber to townships to get people on the internet. He said, however, that it was so frustrating. We wanted to democratize the internet to make it affordable for people. For 100 rand a month, you could get full broadband, and that was the product we wanted to roll out, but we were stopped. More than just the length of time, the process was characterized by U-turns and uncertainty. The Competition Appeal Court first ruled against the takeover, but this was originally set aside by the Competition Tribunal in August. He says that even now they are still waiting for ICASA to grant approval. He went on to say, why are America and some countries so successful? It's because they've got entrepreneurs who have the ability to start businesses without red tape that can close down business if they don't work. They can employ people. If it doesn't work out, they can get rid of people without having all those shackles around them. He said these regulations only police big businesses, but small businesses are just choked by them. The senior economist at Stanlib said that these types of regulations, mostly from the Competition Commission and from all the various regulatory organizations like ICASA that grant all these licenses and approvals, is the main thing holding back our economy. Now, she makes the argument that BEE is a lesser part of that problem. And, you know, I think that's a thing that one can argue over for a long time. But the point is well taken that there are a lot of regulatory structures in South Africa that basically, you know, don't really add any particular value and yet gum up the works and slow things down very significantly. Herman, what do you make of this one? I mean, you know, I think the Competition Commission is something that we've, you know, railed against many times on this podcast because it is just this thing that, you know, does it really create competition? Well, you know, South Africa, small business is strangled and big business kind of makes deals with government. So if its goal is to create great competition, it never seems to do an amazing job at it. All it really seems to do is prevent our economy growing. What's your take on all this?
And Ndivuo Nchitenze, the senior economist at Stanlib, gives such a clear quote here. The amount of regulation governing business is the highest in the world in South Africa. We have more regulation than China does. And that's saying something, since China is a communist country built on regulating everything. Now, you know, if it quacks like a duck and walks like a duck, there's it might be a communist. But the problem with the Competition Commission is it seemed to misunderstand its role. And that is where we get to fundamental beliefs mattering and why, as always, kumbayaist politics is something that we cannot take seriously. It is a political reality, but as a policy engine, it is a recipe for disaster. Can't they all just get along? Well, no, because in the one sense, if you are a state that believes business is based on the exploitation of the worker and the consumer, the Competition Commission will act with that assumption of malintent. So it will always see the frustration of process as either the delay or the frustration of malintent. However, if you move from the basic assumption that businesses exist to serve their customers and that in an economy, the successful businesses are the ones that offer the best products and services at the best price, then the Competition Commission can act in a way that protects genuine competition to make sure that the market stays fair for open entry and contest. So when we get a party like the DA from a liberal tradition and a pro-business bias in terms of business is a net good for society, not a pro-big business or pro-corporate, pro-business, pro-entrepreneurship, pro-enterprise. Perhaps let me use that word, a pro-enterprise assumption about the economy. Compare it to the ANC's basic assumption since the 1950s, that it is anti-enterprise because enterprise means exploitation, then you do run into fundamental incoherence. And that is why people waiting for the GNU to be a policy reformist government will be holding their breath for as long as the GNU survives. Because at the end of the day, your base assumption about what is an enterprise trying to accomplish will determine what regulation, oversight, all of that means. Because you do get something like good regulation. You do get something like bad regulation. You do get something like good bureaucracy and bad bureaucracy, where good bureaucracy allows for a transparent, predictable, efficient, and sort of auditable trail of decision-making so that decision-making doesn't get cluttered at the top. That's a good bureaucracy, is to take as many decisions in a predictable way so that the complexity of the decision elevates to the seniority of the decision-maker. That's good bureaucracy. Bad bureaucracy.
And to do them quickly, a really important feature of this, because this is even in countries with pretty good bureaucracies that are pretty reliable, you still often will have bureaucrats who are like, well, you know, like we're going to be out by lunch, so I guess we'll do it tomorrow. and that can be damaging for businesses.
And that goes back to the base assumption as to what the point of the bureaucracy is. Is it just there to tick boxes, or is it there to empower? And it's sort of like training wheels on a bicycle for a child, good. On a motorcycle, not great. I mean, it'll kill you. So bad bureaucracy is the type of thing that we see too much of in South Africa, where regulations exist to frustrate, quote unquote, exploitation, what other people would call enterprise, and to essentially not create paper trails for sensible decision-making and auditing, but to just tick the box to make sure that there's layers of decision making, because the decision making functions in
lots of
also compromised.
Lots of arbitrary approval by ministers and officials and politicians, and that
discretion.
Those arbitrary things, you know, create that discretion, creates this huge space for corruption. I mean, South Africa is unique in that we have both a slow and inefficient bureaucracy and a bureaucracy whose rules are bad that allows it to have way too much control over things. If we had only one problem, we'd be in a much better space. But we currently have both of those, which is one of the reasons why we have such low economic growth.
Absolutely. And then perhaps to close off this point, is this isn't the first time that this sort of foot dragging is costing South Africans in very real terms. For 15 years now, the private medical industry have been trying to create affordable, low-cost, entry-level medical cover packages so that for 100, 200, 300 rand a month, people can have the basic care they need for the real, tangible medical risks they face. What has stopped that has been the government and regulatory bodies every time saying, you didn't do this right, you didn't tick that box, and then the industry would come back, actually, we did. Then there would be an appeals process or a revision process. And then it would go on, and then the government or the minister or somebody would say, actually, court challenge, you actually need to include this coverage. You need to include, you know, AIDS coverage in this, or antiretrovirals in this, or pregnancy medication in this, stuff that really just design mission creep and slows down the process. Yeah. So what we see here with connecting townships to the internet in the age of information has happened time and time and time again before.
Yeah. Now, I was reading something that some of our colleagues also shared on internal groups about India's bureaucracy and its judiciary, which are very fascinating to read, because, of course, India is a country that's having this huge economic growth, and it's seeing a rise similar to what China went through in the 90s. And yet, you know, it still has these very big problems with its bureaucracy. Like, I think the Supreme Court in India itself has something like 36,000 cases outstanding. And, you know, you can wait 20 to 30 years for a court date, sort of stuff, which is just like completely crazy. And it's like, even South Africa doesn't have a judiciary that inefficient. And yet they still, because they've stripped away some of the rules of the old so-called license Raj, where they had these bureaucrats and lawyers and things who could, you know, slow down everything. They stripped away just enough to open the door to economic growth. You don't even have to go the whole way to actually turn this stuff around. You only have to go some of the distance before you start seeing returns on it. And I think that's the key here is, you know, this is not the abolition of all government oversight that we're asking for here. This is not, you know, we should, you know, get rid of driver's licenses. This is like, okay, maybe the Competition Commission can have a actual good reason for stopping something rather than just it's a bit too many fiber, a little bit too much fiber concentration, I guess. You know, we're not gonna, we actually, it's got bad vibes, we're not gonna do that. It just seems to be what they did in this case, because, you know, then who suffers? Well, everyone suffers, but especially the people who suffer are those who are at the bottom, because they don't have an opportunity to stop being poor. Okay. Let's move on to our last topic for today. Herman, you brought this to our attention actually on Monday in one of our internal meetings, and we weren't really sure whether it was worth talking about, because, you know, I think it's probably just going to be a little flash and no one cares anymore. It's barely been reported in the media, but it did get some media coverage. And this is a bill being put forward by Action SA called the Election Integrity Bill to protect South Africa's democracy. So I'm going to read a little bit from the media statement on Action SA's website here. They said, Action SA is proud to introduce the Election Integrity Bill, a legislative proposal aimed at safeguarding South Africa's elections from unscrupulous political polling practices and protecting the integrity of our electoral democracy, which relies on citizens' fair, transparent, and informed participation. They say that this bill will enhance election integrity by requiring all published polls to disclose sponsors, methodologies, and other relevant information, establish the Office of the Polling Ombud as an independent oversight body, another regulatory body, with the Electoral Commission to regulate political and exit polling, and prohibit the publication of political opinion polls related to an election within 7 days prior to voting day. Herman, I must say, Action SA really has its finger on the pulse of the national consciousness here. As we all know, the people in the streets are crying out for greater regulation of the polling industry. But you looked into this, and what were your thoughts?
Well, the first thing that is quite funny is that if this law had been, or if this bill had been law in 2021, ActionSA would fall foul of it. On the 26th of October, 2021, they published an opinion poll on Tswane showing that they would get 25% of the vote, or that they were on 25% of the vote at that time. ANC roughly the same, DA roughly the same. Three horse race was the idea. Now, that was within a week of polling day. So that's the 7-day thing, you know, oopsie. But then the election came and they got below 10%. So either they lost 15 percentage points in a week, either they suck at campaigning or they suck at polling. And I've asked them which one it is, and they've been unable to provide me with an answer. So I think that example of a poll being obviously bogus, not taken very seriously, and yet not seeming to have swung the election in any direction is a perfect example as to why this bill is stupid. Because if that election could swing on a poll, I'm pretty sure that poll, with all its inaccuracies, would have done it magically. I mean, to my eternal surprise, an opinion poll didn't swing the election. And the problem you have with ActionSA...
Are you telling me that most voters don't look at the opinion polls and then make the decision based off of who's already in the lead? I mean, look, is there an argument in a really, really close race that opinion polling can tip things one way or the other, or that when a party is choosing between two candidates to put forward that opinion polling? Sure. But like the idea that every South African is firstly so plugged in as to even pay attention to political polling. I mean, that's step number one, as in being completely ridiculous, right? Like, you know, talking about polling, we get a little bit of media attention, you know, from some of the big news organizations in the country. And probably about 90% of South Africans have no idea that was published. Even if we get in like News 24 and Business Day and on all the podcasts and stuff, like 90% of South Africans have no idea. It's like, it's just a silly argument on its face. Anyway, sorry, it's just gone.
No. It's absolutely right. Because if you're going to call something an election integrity bill, surely there should be a connection between the integrity of the election and what you propose. That seems not to be the case. The entire link in election integrity and polling is that polling has become this massively influential publication force that has swung elections. And as you say, Nick, I find it difficult to take seriously.
We do polls. Full disclosure, we publish the occasional political poll, and we wish we had such magical powers to manipulate and shape the environment, but no such luck, I'm afraid.
I've written about 4 or 5 polling reports now, and I haven't yet swung an election. Either I'm bad at my job at swinging elections, or polls are just polls, and they're not sort of these Machiavellian sources of influence that ActionSA seem to think they are. But
besides, read the comment section under any polling report, and it'll be filled with people who don't like the result saying, this is fake.
Yes, and that's their absolute right to do. It's one of the weirder things that political polling, which is so testable, because it is comparable against an actual result. It's not as if it's unfalsifiable. Election polling, by definition, is falsifiable the moment the election results come through. And then people can see, that one was quite close, that one didn't do well. And people can decide whether they take it seriously or not. But the idea that millions of voters are subject to the influence of polling is really so ridiculous that it becomes very difficult to take the bill seriously. And then that is made worse by the fact that at one point they start talking about opinion and exit polls, not polls. And then it's just like, the prompt that wrote this bill on ChatGPT clearly got a bit wacky and started talking about exit tolls and opinion tolls. And what makes it sort of even worse than that is that this thing could carry a 2-year prison sentence if you publish an unsanctioned poll. I mean, I don't even, where do you start? What are you in for? No, embezzlement. You murder. Me? I published an unsanctioned poll. Oh, you scumbag. You will shank you in the showers this evening. So to take, and I think I know where this comes from. Actionist A were a 3% party for a year out from the election. They were a 3% party. And they didn't want to be a 3% party. They wanted to be a 5 or a 6 or a 7 or an 8 or a 10% party. They wanted to be the largest party in Gauteng. Herman Mashaba said they would be. And then they weren't. And sort of they've now taken aim at the messenger, despite the messenger, except for one poll, overestimating Actionist A's support. So they were estimated to be low on support, and they went even lower. So yeah, the pollsters got Actionist A's support levels wrong. They said they'd get 3%. They ended up with 1.2%. And I can understand that that's embarrassing, but the answer isn't to shoot the messenger. If they had understood even the basic tracking of, you know, social media or sentiment, the types of tools that are so freely available that I wrote a whole bloody book about, you get to a point where you understand it's really not the mechanism telling you you're awful that's making you awful. It is the fact that you're just perhaps bad at this. And that's the sad thing. It's pathetic in a way, in a country with gender-based violence, unemployment, corruption, malnutrition, crime, and polling? Is that really up there on that list? I don't know, I don't know.
No, Herman, I think you're just not hip to what's really going on, that us of the IRR are actually controlling the country's political system behind the scenes, which is why every policy we proposed is immediately implemented by government. Oh, no, wait. Hang on a second.
Famously.
Anyway. Famously. That's not to say we don't have an impact, but man, we have to work at it to get anywhere. And
It took us 10 years to apply enough pressure to the DA to get rid of race-based policy in 2019 and 20. And then it took a further 5 years for sort of value for money to enter the conversation. So our work, I think we do deliver, but we don't regulations.
We've been critical of many government policies. You know, we've been critical of BEE since the beginning. And the debate is only turning around now after literally decades of work. And that is the reality, is that the contest over the public space, over what's acceptable, what's not, what are good ideas, what are bad ideas, is a hard fought thing. And a couple of opinion pieces or a viral poll on social media once off really doesn't make that. It takes years and years to actually make real change. Anyway, before we get way too deep into the weeds about the universe, life, and everything, thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show fascinating and enjoyable, and we will see you tomorrow on The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone. Have a great day.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.